Well, welcome to JSA's end of the week conference call. This is Kevin Clausen, and I have Gunnar and Wayne on with me as well. Well, fellas, this has been one heck of a week from the opening kick on Sunday right up to the close this afternoon. So I think I can speak for everybody in the industry. We're thankful for Friday afternoon and a couple day break from the markets. And we'll all be anxiously awaiting how we come in Sunday evening. Take you back to last Friday, we saw, you know, major risk off in the markets, only to put it all back on right out the gate on Sunday. Closing limit up Monday and Tuesday on corn to start the week. The war in Ukraine escalated over the weekend and just continued to escalate throughout the week, which added risk premium in all of the markets. You just take a look at crude, for example. I mean, we're up $8 right now, trading at $116 versus last Friday's close of under $92. So it's just another signal of how much risk premium has been added into these markets from Friday's sharp sell-off all the way to today's session. We'll take a little bit closer look at corn. May corn closed at 754 and a quarter, which is up 98 and a half cents on the week. We traded a $1.09 range on the week, setting the low at the very beginning of the week, and then setting the high tick when we were limit up this morning before closing up 6.5 cents today. So just a very volatile week, obviously, and a volatile session again today. Spreads were firm as well, despite taking a little bit of a breather today. You take a look at the May-July last week, closed at 11 and three quarters and traded as high as 52 and a half today before settling back at 33 here on the close. But overall, just a very, very firm week on corn spreads. The cash markets have been really volatile as well. CIF has been firm and barge freight has been very firm with, you know, spot barge is almost impossible to come by. And I think that's just a reflection of the strong demand that we're seeing there on the river. On the flip side, we're seeing very weak markets in the interior at the processor level. The futures rally and the spreads firming have kept corn moving into a pipeline in the interior that was already plugged nearby. So over the last several days, we have seen several bids rolled to the July, you know, and taking, you know, just cash bids significantly lower as a result. And I think that's just a combination of we've had very good weather, good prices, a lot of grain moving on the interior, and a lot of ownership at the end user level that is causing people to step back from these markets. And if this rally continues, I would expect to see the interior markets significantly weaker again next week. We'll shift gears to ethanol production. It came in lower at 997 versus 1024 the previous week and versus the 4 week average of 1006. Stocks were a little lower as well, 24,993 versus the 4 week average of 25,195. So good to see stocks backing off just a little bit. We'll take a look at exports. Monday export inspections came in at 1.5 million metric tons versus expectations of 1.3. On Thursday, we did have a pretty good daily reportable export sale of 337,000 metric ton to unknown. That was the only daily reportable sale that we had this week. Weekly corn exports were disappointing, though, with old crop at 485,000 and new crop at 223,000. Or old crop sales were well below last week's 1 million metric ton level and expectations for 1 million plus this week. Of note, Japan was the largest buyer, taking over 75% of the total sales. I would say we do anticipate corn demand to continue to pick up, though, as you know, the world buyer is definitely looking to the U.S. as a hedge against just the major uncertainty that we're seeing in Ukraine. Last note, I'll touch on South American weather. You know, South American weather has improved again this week. This will help the second corn crop. Argentina crop conditions are just slightly better this week. you know, we're all well aware of the damage that's been done to that first corn crop. So the, some of the very late planted stuff will be helped here. And, but overall conditions do look, you know, more favorable today than they have for quite a while. So something we're going to need to keep an eye on as we start putting more focus on that second Safrinha crop. But as we all know, that South American weather story and South American production has just taken a major backseat to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And I won't go any further on that. I'll leave that more for Wayne. So heck of a volatile week. That's all I got on corn. I'll hand it over to you, Gunner, on beans.
Hey, thanks, Kevin. Beans on the week. May beans settled at 1660 and a half. I've got that up 76 cents on the week. May meal settled at 460.40. That was up 1770 on the week. And May oil settled at 72.80, up 3.87 cents on the week. No beans, if you're following that, that settled at 14.50 and a quarter. That was up 35 and a quarter on the week. May crush margins, call 153. Even 153 and a quarter, I'm calling it five and a half cents higher on the week. May palm oil futures on the week up 310. Last night though, down 532. Oil as a percentage of the crush ended up on the week at 44.2%. Ice canola, the May contract up 37.8 Canadian. At 1,070.5 Canadian dollars per metric ton. The thing, palm was down 532. We've got an awful lot of talk or rumors circulating that a lot of these foreign countries may be foregoing their biofuels blending requirements. Indonesia's got a big one. Brazil's got one. Again, that's I think that's what got into the palm overnight. Over the Black Sea, you know, with the Russian-Ukraine war going on, people are talking about wheat and corn, but another big commodity for those two countries are sunflower seeds, both seeds, sunflower meal, and sun oil. When you look at the both Russia and the Ukraine, they represent about 80% of the world sun meal trade, sun meal export trade. The world exports about 9.2 million tons. Sun oil, on the other hand, that to me is a little bit more interesting. I've got Russia exporting, at least per the USDA numbers, exporting 3.8 million tons, Ukraine exporting 6.65, and that again is running about 78%. And total world sun oil exports are 13.3. You know, the thinking is if the war is going to continue, where do you make that up? Just to go through some figures again, world sun oil is 13.3. World soy exports are 12.2. Canola is 5.6. Palm's the big one at 49.7. But if those sun oils are displaced, it's going to get tight. It's going to get tight. Cash market, as Kevin mentioned, under pressure. Barge freight on the, you know, last week I had barge freight going home Friday at 600%. It's 850, and we saw them move the SIF from March to May. Just to give you a ballpark idea, last week Friday going home, Hennepin was 27 over. If you want to use 17.5 as delivery value equivalent, you know, clearly above delivery value, whereas last night's sheet had been at a penny over. Carnival ended, Fat Tuesday, Ash Wednesday. So Brazil was closed for most, Brazil and Argentina. They celebrate in both countries. So there wasn't a lot of news out of those two. But Buenos Aires Grain Exchange, they left their crop at 42 million. That was unchanged. They raised the conditions 1% to 25%. We're still, it's March 4th. I'm going to say we're still probably 2 to 4 weeks away from getting anything cut there in beans. Wayne, correct me if I'm wrong. Does that sound about right? 2 to 4 weeks for bean harvest for Argentina. Let me see.
Yes,
out of thank you. Brazil, I don't know. I didn't see anything on Ag Rural. They do a real nice job. But I think last Monday they came out with Brazil harvest. Don't quote me on this, but I'm going to say about 43%. So I would assume we'll see Monday Brazil pushing over 50%. News. The only other thing that I saw out of Brazil was February exports. They came out at 6.27, and that was versus a year ago of 2.6. Again, last year they had a very, very wet harvest. Export sales on the first thing out was the renewable diesel number, and the renewable diesel number, the feedstocks that we used in the month of December came out at 937.4 million pounds of bean oil, and I'm pretty sure, at least looking at my data, I believe that is a record for 1 month. So that was encouraging. And that was the monthly biofuels feedstock number. Then we came out with a crush on, March 1. The crush for the month of January, for January came in at 194.2. You know, good number, a little bit less than what people were looking for. The NOPA members only contributed about 10 million bushels versus the month before. They were contributing about 11.8 million bushels. Came out with sales. You take a look at the crush pace, and for me, we're pretty much right on line at 2,215. When you look at the fundamentals and you look at what's going on, again, I talked about the sunflower seed. I would assume that the world's going to have to pick up veg oil somewhere. They're also going to have to pick up a protein due to lack of sunflower seed meal. And then the issues that are going on with South America, I think there's a chance that the USDA could raise the crush. On the next WASD report, export sales came out on Thursday. Good bean sales at 31.5. That puts us at 1,843 for the year. We only need to average 8, so I would assume the USDA could raise that figure also. And we had huge new crop sales. We've already eclipsed last year's pace. And if, you know, I have to imagine next Thursday's number going to be just as big, because it seems like every day we get multiple bean announcements. So we've got good demand. Obviously, we've got some external factors that are unknown right now. I would suspect we'll continue to be firm in the soy complex. Wayne?
Thank you. Thank you, Gunnar. I'm going to start out just say that Rabobank put out something recent in the last half hour or so saying that the markets have not priced in all of the Black Sea problems. And I'll let that stand for whatever. Stefan Vogel is the head of that. I've met him many times. I admire him. Not sure I completely agree with that, but that's the attitude of the market right now. Also, before I start talking about the Black Sea, I want to mention that the winter wheat in Ukraine has been out of dormancy for several weeks now, as they've started their spring is about 25 to 30 days earlier than normal. And if you were in Odessa, you'd think you were in Kansas in terms of the climate. And by the time you got to Kyiv, which is 300 miles north, you'd be more like Nebraska. So the maturity of the wheat crop right now is similar to what it would be in Kansas in a normal year in late March. So good rains in April, May, perfect for Kansas, same kind of thing for Ukraine. So I'm going to say that we as I look back on the last week to 10 days, I think there were three phases. When we first heard what was going on, the first thought was, oh, there's a shortfall of exports. And I think we traded all of that over last weekend and on Monday. And then we started hearing stories about people who had looked into the seed production, hybrid seed production for corn and sunflowers, and had reached the conclusion that all of the places where they do that are right in the middle of the country, and they're at risk of not either getting the chemicals they want or just not being able to do what they want. And that for that is a problem for the people like Pioneer and Monsanto and about two dozen other companies that provide all the seed for next year. That could be a problem for them. We traded that concept. And then we also started thinking, well, if that's a problem, then maybe we won't be able to produce the kind of crops in 2023 that they need to recover, even if the war has wound down. And so I think of that third phase is what we've been trading for the last 48 to 72 hours for sure. And I'm going to address all of those as I go along here, and bear with me. This is wheat is a complex animal, and this whole situation is, as you might suspect, quite complex. So let's just talk what we know about the Black Sea ports right now. The Sea of Azov, which is that sea that's off to the northeast of Ukraine. And if you want to imagine what I'm talking about, put your left hand palm up and aim it towards your right shoulder, and then fold back your bottom three fingers, and your pointer finger is pointing at the city of Rostov, which is in Russia, and that the shoreline that runs down the top of your finger is southeastern Ukraine, and that's where Mariupol is, which they've written about as being surrounded, has been taken by the Russians, and that goes on down towards Kherson, or Kherson as they say, which also has been a lot of fighting. If you looked at down towards the heel of your hand, that would be where Crimea began. And so that, and that all the area to the east of that is the Sea of Azov. And it's completely, the only completely closed for marine traffic except for the Russian Navy. And the ports on the other side include, as you go further south, include Novorossiysk, which is their biggest port for exporting everything. So the Sea of Azov is closed. One of the really successful loading platforms that they have sits on a floating platform in the northern Sea of Azov, and it's used to load coasters that can bring barges out of the Don River and just load them right into Handymax, and it can go to anywhere in northern Turkey or even into the Black Sea or the Mediterranean Sea. That's not operating. Novorossiysk is open, but very few people can get the Panamax vessels that they want. They also can't afford the insurance, which is $200,000 to $300,000 per cargo, and they also probably cannot get the trade finance that they want, because most banks in Russia, even if they're not, if they're SWIFT, if they still have SWIFT numbers, banks on the outside of Russia will not trade with them, because they don't know whether that they will get sucked into a situation where a SWIFT number, a bank, suddenly is also banned. So there's no trade finance, and most of the elevators along that shore and any ships are full of grain, but they can't go anywhere. The other issue is that there are no buyers. GASC put out a tender request. They got it offered three cargoes of French wheat, and they turned it down because the price was over $400 a ton delivered. So that's the only kind of offer that has been seen. It's possible that some ships from Novorossiysk will come out of there and go down the coast and eventually end up delivering grain to Iran through the Arab Sea, but that's that's ongoing to business that they've had for a long time, and it's just delivering the wheat to comply with contracts. Just looking at my notes here. The other part of it is that if a Russian exporter completes a sale and is ready to deliver it, he has to convert 80% of, they say, the earnings from the cargo to rubles immediately. So that's one way of trying to get around some of the limitations on conversions, or try to finance things at the government level, but it's not helping the exporter, especially if you can't get trade finance. The potential FOB price, if you could get something, this is a ghost number, but ICAR, whom we rely on heavily for a lot of information about prices over there, said that he thinks that if they could load and they did have all of that, the price would be somewhere between $350 to $370 a metric ton. When Kansas City May was trading $11.50 today, that's $423 a metric ton, and that's not, doesn't include any elevations at Houston. So the questions are facing everybody. I'm going to shift now to trying to talk about how much exports are we short, and then talk about the issue of what happens with the 2023 crops. A couple of things that have happened this week that I don't think everybody is pricing in, and I believe that I am much more conservative on how many exports remain to be shipped out of Ukraine and Russia for both corn and wheat, but I'll get to that in a second. India became a reasonably sized exporter of wheat this last year. They were aiming to export 7, and there was some evidence today to think that they are this week. That they have now decided that they might be able to ship as many as 10. And there was some offered to some people that I heard from yesterday afternoon. Can they do that and affect their stocks? Well, they carry big, they have big stocks to usage ratios. With 7 million tons of exports, they were going to be 27% stocks to use, and with 10, they would be 20. And they've been that low before in the last 10 years. So if they think their crop looks pretty good, it may be a way for them to take advantage of the situation. The next one that is a complicated, it's simple, but it's complicated. One of the ways that WASD confuses the trade, and particularly people who don't follow all this stuff correctly, is that they estimate much higher exports out of Russia than the market thinks is going to happen, and particularly the people in Russia. So for 6 months, WASD has been saying that Russia was going to export 35 million metric tons of wheat. ICAR went down to 31.5 about 60 days ago, and this week he ran that down to 27.5 because of all the problems at the ports, and that's how much they had shipped 24 million tons by the end of February. So they only have 3.5 million tons that they need to get out to get to 27.5. And most of that's probably going to go to Iran. So that's certainly possible to occur. So the difference between 35 and 27.5 is 7.5 million tons. So I think they have 3.5 million tons left to export. Some people who are just looking at WASD, I think it's 7.5. So 4 million tons is 50 million tons, million bushels, the difference. And that's a huge factor. I also have felt for several weeks that Ukraine had only 4 million tons of wheat left to ship. I saw some numbers here today that people were talking about 6 or 7. I just don't think that was going to be in the cards. And that's based on information from the people in Ukraine in Kyiv that we work with. So I think that the potential loss of exports is about 8 million tons, four out of Russia, four out of Ukraine. We also know that hard red wheat conditions are poor in the U.S., but we don't know how that's going to play out for another 90 to 120 days. It looks like Russia is going to have a good crop of something like 79 to 80 million versus 76 and 21. And Ukraine was expecting a crop before all this started of a 28.4, down 3.5 from this past year. So those numbers don't suggest that anybody would be afraid to try to continue shipping wheat if they had the wheat available. So I don't see anything that in those numbers that causes me to panic about being able to find a place where those 8 million tons can come from. Three of it can come from India alone, and the ABARS people about 10 days ago raised the size of the Australian crop by another 600,000 tons. So I think they could probably get another million tons out of Australia. So you're talking about 4 million tons, 3 million tons, 4 million tons. Let's just say it's three, and then you're talking about less than 100 million bushels that you have to find somewhere, which is a lot different from 8 or 9 million tons that I think some people are thinking about. Let's just talk about the seed situation. And I have talked to some people here in the U.S. who are involved in Ukraine heavily. And I know that it's a serious concern because the seed business, where they're producing the grandparent and the parent seed and also contracting with farmers to grow the seed this summer that will be used to sell to farmers next year, are all pretty much situated up and down the Dnipro River. That nuclear power plant that was attacked by the Russians in the last couple of days is in a town called Zaporizhia, which if you imagine where the Dnipro River is down from Kyiv, and it makes a big right-hand turn and goes towards the Black Sea. That's where Zaporizhia is. And that's sort of the southern boundary of where seed operations are located. And you could go 200 miles north of there and 100 miles east-west of there, and that's where most of the seed would be produced. Gunnar was talking about sunflower seed. It's hybridized, and about 25% of that seed, commercial seed, is grown from Zaporizhia off to the northeast up to that town Kharkiv, which they've been bombing into oblivion. So there is no reason to think that there probably are interruptions going on, and we've been told that people haven't been able to get the fuel to do what they want to do, at least early on here. So it is a problem, but there's nothing else we can say right now about it other than it's something that you have to be concerned about. The spring sowing and chemical application, we've asked some questions over the people in Kyiv, what they think about that. The only one that we know of for sure is that field peas, which are planted early, and spring came a month early this year in Ukraine. So there's a lot of that stuff that people are trying to do. But just like with the seed people, there are shortages of fuel to be able to do what they want to do. So I've addressed the issue of the shortage of exports, and I said I think that it's manageable, particularly if you realize that the USDA's WASDE number is, I believe, way too high and has been for quite a while. Who are the people that need that? North Africa, they're having a drought across most of Northern Africa, so they will need wheat from either Europe or other people. We used to sell a lot of wheat to North Africa, so it's possible if the prices are right. The Middle East, probably still some, and Western Africa and Nigeria, places like that, probably need some additional wheat. Let's talk about crop shortages quickly, and then we'll wrap this up. The if you take a look at Ukraine's crop, which was 32 million tons or last year, and say that's normal, even though they were expecting to do 28 to 28 and a half, let's just say you cut it in half, and it goes to be 16 million tons. So you've lost 15 million tons of the crop, whether it didn't get planted or it got run over by tanks or yields because nobody could get in to take care of it or it was harvested late, you name it. If you had that situation, you'd be looking for imports of probably something on the order of 10 to 12 ton increase from this year. And so where do you go to get that? Well, last year, the combined Canadian and U.S. loss of spring wheat was about 12 or 13 million tons. And the winter weather in Canada has been quite favorable. And the only dry place so far in the hard red spring areas of the U.S. is in western North Dakota and a little bit of northeastern Montana. So if you picked up 10 or 12 million tons there, not everybody uses the spring wheat that grows there that wanted the bread wheat from Russia at 12 and a half pro, or from Ukraine, it's 11 and a half or 12. Not everybody uses that same wheat, but there are bushels that will be available. I think soft red wheat probably will be up by 50 or 60 million bushels. I think hard red wheat still is going to struggle. You know, I've been saying that with conditions where they are, if they stay this bad through early May, then we could lose a couple of million tons of hard red wheat production versus year ago. So again, that's not a perfect solution, but it's not the, oh my God, the crop failed. There's nothing that we can do about it. And it's 30 million tons that we can't find. Then there's the question of, well, what if Ukraine also, in addition to Ukraine, what if Russia also loses some crops? They're looking for a slight increase. Their crop last year was 76. They're looking for some number like 79 to 80. The weather there has been quite favorable. But what if they lost 8 or 9 million tons? This is the point where the market begins to get troubled, because if they lost that much, then, and I was assuming that the 10 to 12 million tons of more U.S. and Canadian spring wheat offset something, you can't do it. You just can't do the math of that. So having a shortfall of something like combined between the two countries of, say, 22 to 24 or 5 million tons would be a serious issue for the markets. And I think we've traded it. We've shown what the market fears this week if the losses are that sizable. I don't think anybody has in mind anything, a specific number. They probably haven't gone through an exercise like this. But I would say that if they certainly think that losses are that high, then 1150 plus is certainly, we've seen it happen. On the other hand, if it's the less onerous losses, it's possible, I think, that that prices don't need to be above $400 a metric ton to supply a lot of the losses. And you could, I believe, this is my first guess at it, that a Kansas City price somewhere between $850 and $1050 is more likely than 13 to 15, or whatever people have in mind. And I'm going to say one last thing. I have spent 2 days trying to figure this out, and I reserve the right to change some of the numbers, but it's my best guess as to what's going on there now. And I think it's that we've priced in, for now anyway, a lot of the fear. It doesn't mean that the money mutt guys in there won't be some more panic if Ukraine loses control of some portion of the country. But those are my parameters on where I think you can put some markers down and try to keep your mind, keep in your mind how all that's working out. So that's all I have today, guys. You'll see a lot of this in a better written form in my report next week. Have a good weekend.
You too, Wayne. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.